Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's podcast for November 1st, 2006 on davidbix.com. I'm joined here today by the artist formerly known as Craig Johnson, John Horton, who currently is involved in television production and this weekend made his return to wrestling announcing, but as himself, for AWA Pinnacle in Washington. And many achievements in wrestling he's achieved. He was one of the writers for the Shen Onomaki Post, which we will talk extensively about. He was half of the world's tallest wrestling announcing team.
I'd actually forgotten about that.
He was called a Richard Grieco lookalike by Eddie Gilbert. Many other things. So how are you doing, John?
I'm doing great. It's actually a nice day out here in Seattle, considering we woke up this morning to 20-degree weather. It's kind of nice to have a cool fall day.
It's actually oddly warm in New York today.
Ah.
For about a week. Yeah, it was getting cold for a few days, but now today it's a little bit warmer, so. That'll change soon, though.
Well, you can't book the weather. We've all discovered that.
Yeah, unfortunately. The weather, though, can be a very good excuse for a show not drawing, though.
Yep.
So, how'd the return go on Saturday?
Oh, it was a lot of fun. It was like riding a bicycle, and thank God I didn't fall off. It was just a lot of fun. I got to work with Wildcard, who's one of the up-and-coming stars of AWA Washington here in the state of Washington. He's half of the tag team of Rolling Too Deep. And we had never worked together before. We had barely even talked. As far as what we wanted to do. And one thing that people probably don't realize is that in my business, sometimes you end up pulling a lot of overnight edit sessions. Well, I do that every Friday night producing a television show for King 5, which is the NBC affiliate out here. So I was working on about 5 hours sleep. And when I am a little bit tired, I tend to get random, and I tend to get a little wacky. And as the show went on, the two of us just started going at each other. And it turned out to be to go back to the old Steve Beverly Matt Watch days, a line of the week contest. Who could come up with a better one? And so it was a lot of fun. The show itself was great. AWA Washington crowned a new champion in Laramie Lexo, who beat T.J. Wilson and Caden Matthews in a three-way match that actually started out just Matthews and T.J. And Lexo came in and really showed that he has the potential of being another big star. You know, Harry Smith just left AWA Washington, and now T.J. Wilson and Natty Neidhart are both being looked at by the WWE, so you never know who may leave next, so we appreciate them while they're there. That's for darn sure.
Now, will you be doing the announcing regularly for Pinnacle, or was this just for the pilot?
This was a pilot presentation. My production company, which is called Flying Colors, out here in Seattle, we produce a mixed martial arts event that's held down in the Auburn Super Mall, an arena that holds about 2,000 people. Pinnacle Wrestling, which is now AWA Washington, started doing some shows down there, and I was introduced to the promoter, Cecil Reed, and we just hit it off. And I said, Cecil, I'd like to do a television show for you. I'm not sure how we're going to do it, but I'd like to do one. So we actually brought in the multi-camera production class of the Art Institute of Seattle, and it became a class project for them. We had 17 kids there who are all college age or older, who are learning how to be television professionals, and they came in and they handled every aspect of the broadcast with the exception of the play-by-play and the color. They brought in big screens, brought in a fog machine, did everything, we just said, take the ball and run with it. And they did. We're going to talk to them about potentially making this a quarterly project where they, each new class comes in, gets to do one of the wrestling shows. From that, we may be able to, and are in late going talks with, the major cable company out here for putting it on their on-demand servers, so because they enjoy having local programming and they'd love to have a pro wrestling show. So that's kind of how it's going. How regular it's going to be, I'm not exactly sure, but it was a great way to kind of dip your toe in the pool to see if you want to dive in or not. And everybody enjoyed it. Now, just as a question of, as it always is, whether we can pay for it or not. And the folks at AWA Washington are trying to get some sponsorship money so we can take care of the expenses, because we all want to do it for the fun of it, because we all enjoy the fun of professional wrestling.
How did the students compare to Video Bob?
Oh, Video Bob, there's a name out of the past. The students were great. One of them, his dream has always been to direct the promos for the WWE. And when we went in and did some promos with Natty Neidhart and with the Exploders, I mean, you would have thought this guy had died and gone to heaven. He was going, now let's try this, and then let's try this. And he took it and ran with it. Video Bob was absolutely wonderful to work with back in Dallas. He was, for those of you who don't know, Video Bob was the producer director of USWA, then Global, and before that World Class, and before that a little Mid-South. And he and I had worked together back in the USWA days, and actually I handled the syndication for the old USWA show as well, working for Max Andrews, and I know we're going to be talking about Max a little later. But Bob gave me a great bit of advice. He said, just go out there and have fun. Don't worry about what we're doing back here. Because I was used to being a radio basketball play-by-play announcer, and here I was out doing professional wrestling, which I'd always wanted to do. He said, just have fun. And so we did have fun. But I actually taught Video Bob something, which to this day he always kind of laughs about. I started calling for replays in the old USWA shows. I would be describing something on the screen, and Bob would get my headset and go, I'm not seeing that. I said, don't worry, you'll put it in post. And sure enough, we started doing replays on USWA, then Global, and that's the same thing that we're going to be doing with the Pinnacle show, is just taking stuff off the original show, rewinding it, and using it as replays. Something you can do when you post-produce a show, as opposed to do it live with a $20,000 production crew, or in the case of TNA or the WWE folks, a lot more than that.
Since you mentioned the syndication, what was the deal with various older USWA stuff just kind of randomly airing on like Channel America and all that, like years later?
There's a company, and I think Mario Savoldi was a part of it, that bought up the USWA tape library.
And now, when was this?
I want to say mid to late 90s, because I know that I would scream in horror when I'd be hearing myself doing a wrestling match years after I'd gotten out of the business. I'm going, why are they still showing this? And then it would also pop up in DVDs like Stunning Steve Austin's Greatest Hits or The Best Matches of Cactus Jack. They bought the tape library, thought they would have a use for second runs of it, and for a long time before they started doing original matches, they just covered up the USWA logo and made their own wrestling federation with old matches.
See, I never saw
a dime from it, by the way.
They actually did W over with Brian Webster and Mario Savoldi on a couple things.
Oh, yeah. I remember when they had dubbed over one of my matches, and I'm like, hey! So, yeah, I must admit, my ego likes hearing some of them.
Yeah, I was actually aware of the Savoldi stuff. I was curious about, now, this is when Global was still around in some form, that you would have on, like, Channel America and all that. I got a bunch of tapes from someone one time. You'd have reruns of USWA Challenge with commercials for the GWF Hotline and stuff.
My guess is that Max Andrews, who owned the television rights, mm-hmm. saw a way that in Channel America and the low power television stations, a way to reuse the footage, and be able to, use the commercials that are sold for the Global Wrestling Federation show, to give the advertisers, or in this case, the hotline, a little extra bump. Places like Channel America don't pay for programming. They do everything on what's called a barter basis, where they'll show your program, but they want to keep half the advertising time. And it's basically a way to get your television show out there, and it's a way for the network to get free programming. That's kind of the way that we worked the mixed martial arts show with the with Comcast here in the Pacific Northwest. We provide them the television show, and they can have whatever advertising within the show they want. Because it's on demand, you don't have to worry about how much advertising that is, because you can always make it longer or shorter depending upon what you want to do. Don't have to do a classic one-hour show anymore.
Those used to be, you know, those satellite channels and stuff used to be, you know, paradise if you were a big wrestling fan, and now they barely exist.
Well, they exist to some extent in very small markets that don't tend to have their own local television station. They serviced a thing called low-power television, mm-hmm. which was seen in a lot of rural areas that didn't get cable or very good television service. And the reason you've seen those die out recently, they aren't totally dead, but the reason you've seen them die out recently is because of the advent of satellite television. A lot of those shows, a lot of the Channel America and America One shows are actually ending up on regional sports, networks such as CFL football, such as the Fight Sports series, which is all repurposed ESPN2 shows. I think Ballroom Boxing, which is done by a guy by the name of Larry Michael, who's also the voice of the Redskins, falls into that category as well. So they become more of a syndicator than a provider of low-power television stations. But it all gets down to barter. It's there's some stations, new sports networks like Masson in down in the Mid-Atlantic Washington D.C. area, and to some extent Sports New York up where you are, that are looking for programs that aren't put on by Fox Sports Net and aren't put on by ESPN that they can fill their 24 hours of sports with. I know that there are a couple of wrestling shows on regional sports networks, although it's very rare these days. Cleveland All Pro Wrestling's on down in Cleveland, the Sports Time Ohio network, which recently went 24 hours. It's available on DirecTV, but unfortunately they have regional restrictions because I've been wanting to watch that show. And the other one is on Comcast Sports Southeast, which is not available on the dish. It's strictly a cable channel that's all through the Southeast. Deep South Wrestling is on there. So you can watch the adventures of Palmer Cannon doing other things down in Deep South, and he's actually much better there than he ever was on SmackDown. I got a chance to see that when I went back to visit my dad over the summer.
So I guess the journey begins with the question of, how did you get into wrestling?
Always a pro wrestling fan. Ever since I was little, I used to watch the WWWF. On Channel 20 in Washington, D.C., with a very, very young Vince McMahon doing the play-by-play. That and roller derby came on one right after the other on Sunday nights, and I used to love watching both of them. When I moved to Dallas to go to school at Southern Methodist University, the Sportatorium was there, and I went, I've got to go down and see this. I love wrestling. I used to go to County Hall and Charleston, South Carolina on Friday nights when I'd spend my summers in South Carolina. So to have a weekly wrestling show down in Texas was a lot of fun. And this was in the heyday of the Freebirds and the Von Erichs and Chris Adams and Gino Hernandez and, you know, the absolute hottest time in pro wrestling in Texas, with the old World Class days. And, out of college, I got involved with Lee Martin Productions, which is the group that took over from Continental Productions, Channel 39 in the waning days of World Class Championship Wrestling. And at the time, they had a guy on staff who was handling syndication named Max Andrews, the same Max Andrews. And I told Max, almost as a joke, but I told him, if Mark Lawrence ever decides he wants to take a couple weeks of vacation, call me. I'd love to do the show. So I get a call in May of 1992, I think it was. It might have been 91. I can't keep my dates straight.
I think it was 1990.
Thank you. Well, 1990. See, I really can't keep my dates straight. And he said, John, Mark Lawrence is not going to be able to make the show. Are you still interested in doing it? And this time I'd move back to Washington, D.C. And I was the voice of the George Washington University Colonial basketball team. So I said, sure, I'm not doing anything this summer. If you need a replacement for the summertime, I'd love to come on out. So on my birthday, May the 12th, which is also my son's birthday, he'd be quick to remind you of that, I walked into the offices of Andrews Entertainment in Las Colinas in Dallas, and there's Jerry Jarrett sitting there, and Jerry goes, well, what do you know about wrestling? And I said, well, do we want to keep the door open, or does everybody here know this, know the deal? He goes, everybody here knows the deal. I said, okay. I said, your tag team champions are the Midnight Rockers, Steve Dahl and Rex King. Your heavyweight champion is Jerry Lawler, who had won it from Kerry Von. And I went through the history of his company. He goes, how do you know all this? I said, it's called doing homework. And he said, well, have you ever done the play-by-play of professional wrestling before? I said, absolutely not. But I've done play-by-play of sports, every other sport that you can imagine, for the past, this was 1990, so for the past 9 years. I said, I've been doing play-by-play since 81. And he said, well, how do you approach this? I said, I'm going to do it just like a regular sport. I said, I want to know who's taking on who so I can, put together a little stat pack or a little biography of each one, and I'm going to ask him questions. Now, let me ask you something. Can I talk about their past, even if they didn't wrestle for you? And that was the biggest change that I think I brought into the industry, if I can pat myself on the back. Thank you, Barry Horowitz. But I think the biggest change I brought to the industry was the fact that I threw open the curtain and talked about the history of the guy. Like Steve Dahl, I believe, had been in the AWA at one point. And I said, here's a former AWA wrestler now wrestling in the USWA. And the workers loved it. They were like, oh my God, I have a past. And when I went back after my first intermission, we had our intermission, I went back to the back, said, how am I doing? And everybody's going, oh my God, you've been doing this for years, haven't you? I said, nope, first time. And the thing was, I was treating it as though it was a regular sporting event. I wasn't trying to get anything over. I wasn't trying to put one person over the other. I was just treating it like two competitors out there. And I never wanted to know the finishes of the matches. Because to me, it took away, everybody always talk about the fact that I had this gee whiz attitude. Well, the fact was, I didn't want to know what the finishes were because I wanted to be surprised just like a fan would be. So I wasn't a part of the storyline. I just kind of took it in as a fan, and that's kind of how things got started. So here I am getting ready to go back to doing my basketball about 6 months later, there had been some sort of rift between Kevin Von Erich and Jerry Jarrett, and they got thrown out of the sportatorium. So we went and did 3 nights of television taping in Memphis, Nashville, and Louisville, 3 consecutive nights, and my voice was totally gone by the third night. But we had banked over, I want to say, a month and a half or 2 months of programming to the point where they didn't have to worry about it, putting together any shows for the sportatorium. But the funny part about that was, here I was back in Washington, D.C., doing my basketball, and at the time, USWA was obviously syndicated. And on Channel 50, USWA Challenge would come on at 7 o'clock at night. At 8 o'clock, if you did a click over to HTS, which was the regional sport network, there was the George Washington University basketball show. But Craig Johnson was on one station and John Horton was on the other, and they looked amazingly alike. The funniest part about that was I went to the Atlantic 10 banquet a few months later, and I walked into the banquet. Half the people are calling me Craig, half the people are calling me John, because all the players getting ready for their basketball game at night would be watching the 4 o'clock show on ESPN, and they knew me as Craig Johnson, while the basketball officials and coaches knew me as John Horton. It was just strange having a split personality. But that's in a very long-winded form how I started and got me through the USWA days.
Now, you're going to be amazed by my memory here. Was that three-night run of tapings around the Memphis Loop, was that when they did the angle where someone used ether and you said it injured your throat?
It was. Very, very good. Yes, it was. And Jim Cornette covered for me by saying that I had been over at his mother's house all day and she'd been making me soup, and that it just didn't work. But yeah, Cornette worked with us on that last night, and he was just wonderful because he knew basically that my voice had just been shot, and he wanted to help me in whatever way he could. But yes, I do remember. The Nashville tapings were done in the original TNA Asylum, back when it was just the old Fairgrounds Arena. So the first wrestling television taping done in that building was actually by us. It was way before TNA even thought of it. And I think that's how Jarrett realized, you know, I've got an arena that I can do TV in my backyard. Why worry about going anywhere else?
But was the Nashville taping the first appearance of one Oluoliami?
I don't think Olu was there.
I know there was a taping.
I take it back. Olu was there. You are right. That's something I try to block out of my mind because I feel so much for Joe Pedicino when it comes to that. Because I have met con men in my day, and Oluoliami had everybody conned. He was just an out-and-out con man. There's no other way of putting it. And he had everybody believing that he had this ability to finance the organization, and had Joe's heart and soul in it, and had the Overstreet family heart and soul in it. And, you know, they brought in Bill Eady for the original global stuff. And that was to be the start of the turn to the Global Wrestling Federation. Unfortunately, by the time we started the Global Wrestling Federation, it was a much different economic model. Obviously, there wasn't a $25 million check from the Nigerian Oluoliami, but that man did exist. He was a con man, and he had us all fooled. And it's sad because I think the guy who got hurt most by that was a guy that is I'm still to this day very close with, and that's Joe Pedicino.
I guess this leads us to, how did you get hooked up with the Atlanta Boys?
Yeah, the Atlanta Boys or Joe? Because it's two different stories.
Start with Joe.
Well, I'll tell you the Joe story because that's actually a fascinating one. After the very first taping that I did, and after I had moved out to Dallas to be the somewhat full-time replacement for Mark Lawrence, I called. I was looking down the syndication phone list and saw the name Bonnie Blackstone by WVEU Channel 69 in Atlanta, which was our Atlanta affiliate. And I didn't know anybody that could give me a honest-to-goodness opinion on how well I was doing as far as my play-by-play skills were going in professional wrestling. So I just picked up the phone and called Bonnie Blackstone. And I said, Bonnie, I'm familiar with your work from the Superstars of Wrestling in Georgia. I know you guys carry our show. I'm just curious how you think I'm doing from a wrestling professional's point of view. And she goes, well, actually, the person you should be asking is Joe Pedicino. I said, well, how do I get a hold of Joe? He said, he's right here. And she hands the phone to him. And Joe and I talk for probably about 25 minutes, and he kind of gives me a critique, said I'm doing really well. Well, this was at the time that the global rumblings were first starting, and I had no clue. I was absolutely naive to the fact that there was any other promotion. And a few months later, when Joe came out to do what I thought was the USWA hotline to launch that, he was actually in talks with Jared about buying the company and making it into global. And we sat down at Culture's Barbecue in Texas, and he said, I'm just curious, why did you call me that first time? I said, I just wanted to know how I was doing. He said, you didn't know anything about why I'm really here. I said, you're here to launch the hotline. He said, you really don't know why I'm here, do you? And I said, no. He said, well, we're buying the company, and it's going to be called the Global Wrestling Federation. And I said, well, that's kind of good, because I'm only here for as a summertime replacement to Mark Lorenz, and good luck. They go, well, we'd kind of like to talk to you about something. I said, what? He said, we have our announcer picked out, but we'd like you to be the announcer for our number two show. I said, who's the announcer you have picked out? They said, a guy by the name of Eric Bischoff. And I said, well, yeah, I've seen him on the AWA. He's okay. And then we went out to dinner that night, and Joe calls me the next day. He said, you know, I've changed my mind. I think I want to go with you. I've heard some things about Eric that disturb me. I think I want to go with you. And I think Chris Cruz's name had been bandied about as well. So a few months later, I officially took the job as the director of broadcasting for the Global Wrestling Federation, moved down to Atlanta, and out of nowhere, here comes Craig Johnson again. Going down to Atlanta for those first TV tapings, where we did USWA recap show. They were doing the North Georgia Wrestling Alliance show at the same time, and that's how I got involved with the Atlanta boys, Scott Hudson and Steve Prazak. They were doing point-counterpoint segments at the Channel 69 WVEU, and I got to know them pretty well, to the point where I actually ended up going to Scott Hudson's wedding after knowing him for not a long time. And then he and I became broadcast partners. But as Scott decided he was tired of traveling and stayed back in Atlanta, and then the money ran out for bringing me out for Global. So he and I remained friends. Prazak and I remained friends, and that's how the Atlanta boys got started, by going, oh, heck, we got nothing to do on Monday nights. Let's go down and make WCW's life a living hell. And that's how the Atlanta boys got started.
What was that like, the tapings that you would go to?
Oh, wow. It was, I've told this story to a number of people, and they find it really funny, but I dated a woman in Atlanta who just didn't understand me. And I had much more feelings for her than she had for me. And she looked at me one day and she said, the only time I've ever seen you be your normal self is when you took me to wrestling. And what the Atlanta tapings at Center Stage allowed the Atlanta boys to do is we just basically called BS on everything. We decided we're going to come here and have fun. We're going to create our own storylines. We're just going to see what we can get away with. And our first target was Rhubarb Jones, who was the ring announcer at the time, who was a morning guy at the country radio station in Atlanta. And from the very first "Hey Rhubarb, you suck" chant, it just got out of control from there. The very first time we saw Tex Slasinger wrestle in Gainesville, we said, "Oh God, this guy will never work again." And suddenly he shows up in the Center Stage tapings with a masked guy, and we went, wouldn't it be funny if we cheered for him and booed the other guy? Well, it became such a fun thing to do that the WCW people in the back couldn't figure out how to handle it, because we literally had the fans doing it with us. And every time Tex would hit somebody, we'd let out this curdling, "Ah!" And every time Shanghai would tag in, we'd go, "Boo! We want Tex!" And nobody understood what we were doing. Doug Dillinger would come up and say, "Would you please be quiet?" David Crockett would come, "Would you please be quiet?" And we're like, "Hold on, we're fans, we're having fun here." Well, that all came to a head the day that Ric Flair came back from the WWF. And one of the guys who was one of the other members of the Atlanta Boys, there was Lena Sargent, and there was Steve Cohen, who we called Steve's Printing and Graphics because he owned Steve's Printing and Graphics. And there were a couple other guys, and I'm sorry, I can't remember their names right now, and that's awful of me, but it's been a long time.
There was Greg.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
I always forget what his last name is because I've traded tapes with him.
There was Lou Ledinsky, too. Thank you. There's another one for you. But anyway, Steve printed out 500 signs that just had the word Tex on it and handed it to every single person standing in line. So when they got ready to start the taping, everybody held up Tex signs. And they stopped the taping, and Dillinger sent his guys out, and one by one took back every single Tex sign. There wasn't one left in the entire building, and said, "Okay, you guys have absolutely done it here." And we're like, "We're just having fun." And they said, "All right, well, you can stay then." Well, then when Tex comes out, he gets a bigger cheer than Flair does. They're like, "You guys we've got to come to some sort of agreement here. We can't be doing this all the time." And that's about the time the Shinonomaki Post started, because we had to have an outlet for what we were doing.
When I get back to the Post later, I want to go back a little bit to Global now.
Okay.
Were there ever any plans that Global was going to buy the Tennessee end, or was it always just going to be Dallas?
It was always just going to be Dallas. I think Jared wanted to get out of Dallas. I think he had just enjoyed, having his house in Tennessee and just doing his little thing. USWA wasn't working really well in, Dallas, especially since they didn't have an arena, because you have to remember Kevin Von Erich kicked them out of there for the longest time. So remember Michael St. John came in, and the arena had been killed because Kevin had stopped the regular Friday night shows. There wasn't wrestling every Friday night. You used to be able to just depend on it like clockwork, but you couldn't anymore because, you know, Kevin had killed it, unfortunately. So he saw the Global movement as a way to be able to get out of it. And Joe saw the Sportatorium as a great place to shoot the wrestling events because he thought he'd have a good fan base there. Honestly, I think we probably could have gone further if we had shot in Georgia rather than Texas, but I think that's, to this day, I never really truly understood, other than the Max Andrews connection, why we continued to shoot in Dallas. Because we were flying quite a few people from Atlanta to Dallas every week. I think by the time it was all said and done, I flew 44 straight weekends from Atlanta to Dallas in the first year that I lived in Atlanta. I'd never spent a Friday night in my hometown or in the place that I lived.
Now, at one point you were even doing nighttime and then morning tapings the next morning for USWA.
That was the old USWA day and days, and I my favorite story from that was that we would usually finish taping about 11 o'clock, and we'd get there for production meetings at 8:30 the next morning. And I'm a night person. I not anymore. I'm an old man now, but I was a night person back then, and I would like to stay out. And so getting up at 8:30 to try to do 10 a.m. wrestling tapings was just god awful. So I'm there one morning. It's in the middle of what I call the life is hell feud, Akbar versus Jeff Jarrett. I'm sitting there, and Bill Dundee and Jerry Jarrett and Jeff Jarrett and Akbar are all in the room, and they're going over the television format for that day. And I told you, I don't want to know the finishes. So they're just kind of going over things, saying, here's what we want you to try to promote for next week's main event. And I'm kind of half falling asleep. And Jerry goes, and you're following us here, Craig? And I said, yeah, whatever. And about that time, I felt my entire face being engulfed in flames. And I had no idea what the hell was going on. And I literally throw my head back. My head hits the wall. My chair falls over. And everybody in the room is cracking up laughing because Jerry Jarrett had just thrown a fireball in my face.
My God.
And they said, are you awake now? And I went, yeah. They said, well, now you know what's going to happen to Jeff, so now you know how to react. And I went, thanks a lot, guys. So I was the victim of a Jerry Jarrett fireball during a production meeting one morning, and thus learned the secret of the fact that the fireball burns in, which is how you can throw it, and you can get it on somebody, but it might not necessarily burn them unless the actual piece of paper actually lands on you. And even then, it would just be like a little singe because it's meant to consume in, but it creates this huge bit of fire that puts on a great show. But maybe I have a broken kayfabe there with the secret of the fireball. So Akbar goes to do it that day, and his lighter doesn't work. And I'm covered for him. I said, Akbar is adjusting something. I can't figure out what he's adjusting here. And, oh, my God, there's a fireball. But that was my favorite story from the morning TV tapings. My second favorite story from that was a guy was wrestling, I think, Chris Adams one day. And the next Friday, the Dallas police show up. And we're wondering what's going on. And it turns out the guy who was wrestling Chris Adams, was a fugitive and was stupid enough to take the $25 to wrestle on TV that day. Talk about stupid criminals.
Yeah. And also some fine company that Chris Adams kept.
Mm-hmm.
So I take it you were probably glad when the TVT show taped on Saturday mornings got canceled due to all of the spankings and naked pictures of Chris Adams and such?
Well, I like the Channel 11 show because we were able to do just some fun things on that. My favorite blooper of all time, it actually aired, was after the mixed tag, match where they had cut Tony's hair. I'm doing an interview with Percy Pringle, Steve Austin, and Jeannie. And Jeannie and I had become good friends at this point, not romantically. We'd just become good friends because she was starting to date Steve at the time. So Jeannie says to me, we're going to do a great interview. We're going to talk about cutting the hair. I said, okay, that sounds great. So they come out, and on one side is Percy Pringle, and on the other side of me is Steve Austin, and Jeannie's standing in front of me. And she had broken her wrist the night before during the mixed tag match when she landed wrong on her wrist. So here she is trying to hold a pair of scissors with this wrist that's in a cast. And she goes, I'm going to cut your hair, Tony Adams! And she turns and doesn't realize that she's taken the sharp end of the scissors and basically aimed it straight at my crotch and kind of nipped me a little bit. And I have this surprised look on my face like, whoo! And I'm not knowing what to do. Well, Jeannie cracks up on camera and cannot stop laughing. And she just covers her mouth with a cast or whatever, and then looks like she's all flustered and upset. Meanwhile, I'm hitting the microphone to Percy Pringle, and I've walked off to the side. And after we were clear, she came over and she said, "Are you okay, Craig?" I said, "You didn't get me that bad, but it was too damn close." And to this day, I'll go back and look at that tape and just see her cracking up laughing. The other day was a day where Iceman King Parsons and I got into a little bit of a feud. And I just put my hand on his shoulder saying, "Ice, there's a proper time and a proper place for this interview, and this isn't it." And he just hauls off and slaps me. And I fall, and I fell over my shoelace of all things, fall down to the ground. Well, if you watch it in slow motion, the people in the back think wrestling is so real that one man who is holding a baby almost attacks King Parsons for slapping me. Go figure. So we used to say, what has 32 teeth and an IQ of 170 in the first three rows at the Sportatorium? But that's another joke for another day.
Wow. You did not have the best luck on Saturday morning.
No. I'm not a morning person. But it sure was fun to watch those shows on Saturday night.
I was wondering, since this is not something I did not remember at all until a friend gave me a tape of it, what was the deal with Doc and Gordy showing up in the USWIA for like a week at the end, towards the end of the Dallas?
Oh, that was when Pedicino brought him in. That was the part of the precursor to the Global Day. There was a time when they had not associated themselves with WCW yet. And we just brought him in for a one-time-only thing. Gordy was there, and so was Cactus Jack. And it was a great opportunity to just kind of show off of, you know, Gordy is absolutely loved in Dallas. You know, at that time, you know, the Freebird feud had gone way back in the back. But it was just an opportunity because both of them were coming through Dallas for some reason. And I think Jared just booked him on the card and said, hey, it'd be great to have him on there.
Okay. So I guess this leads us to Global, and I need you to I know I emailed you about this, so you should be prepared.
Mm-hmm.
15 years later, I still don't get the whole angle with the boss.
Okay.
So please explain it to me.
The boss was going to be Medusa Michelli.
Okay.
Unfortunately, Medusa got signed by WCW.
Mm-hmm.
So then we're going, okay, who's going to be the boss now? Well, everybody thinks Akbar is going to be the boss. So we said, no, Akbar can't be the boss. So about that time, Max Andrews said, well, what the heck? I'll be the boss. I'm the boss already. And they said, well, nobody would expect it. Well, the problem was, Max Andrews was still a sale, he would handle the syndication, but he also handled the advertising sales. So when he went to meet with M&M Mars, I think it was M&M Mars, who was one of our sponsors at that time, they said, what's this about you betraying your company? And he didn't think of that. So Max quickly became the secret agent who was infiltrating this cartel, and that's why that storyline went to hell in a handbasket. But that's what it was. He was meeting with sponsors, and the sponsors had seen the show and said, what's going on with you having problems with your company? And they thought it was a shoot. So that's why that died a painful death.
I
remember we were... Medusa was one of the people that we were thinking of, and she would obviously be coming in with Eddie. And we thought it would be a nice little shocker there to have a woman boss. You know, I think for a time, I think they were, I may be getting my dates mixed up, but they were even talking about Jeannie when she wasn't being Lady Blossom. You know, so there were all sorts of things that we just wanted to shock the crowd with. You know, there are quite a few things that we will go back and regret, like the Von Steiger brothers, and Barcelona, Spain, Baron Von Steiger. That's what it was. And the English lords. Thank you. You're right. You know, there's some things that we'll go back and go, why didn't we just shoot with the fans, but we didn't. I think that was kind of a Bill Eady, Joe Pedicino decision, that they wanted to have some sort of storyline. I think if you were to start a promotion these days, especially with as smart as the fans are, we didn't give them enough credit. And so we came up with this wacky story, and they said, here's the story. And I went, okay, whatever you say, I'll do it.
For those who were not around at the time, you see, it was explained that the Global Wrestling Federation was, and this was the buzzword that you had to say several times each show, truly global in scope.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And it had existed for many years overseas, especially popular in Barcelona, Spain.
Yep. Yeah.
I forget why Baron von Steiger, the world champion, had to disappear, but the tag team champions were the English Lords.
Yeah.
And they had to retire after being in a tragic car accident.
Tragic car accident? Yes! I forgot about that. It's scary that you know this. Do you have notebooks?
No, I just have an unfortunately good memory for this.
Oh, lordy.
I remember reading the interview with Joe in Wrestling Main Event, and here I am, I'm not even 7 years old, and I'm like, huh?
Well, you know, some things are believable, some things aren't, so let's move on, shall we?
Was that Joe's call, though, or was that...
I think it was Joe Eddie. With a little bit of Bill Eady in there. Which leads me to a funny story from over the weekend. We have a guy wrestling with us. Named Seth Knight, the Canadian superstar, and he was in a match where they were going against two luchadors, both in masks, and he teamed with a luchador. So he said, I feel naked here. I need something. And he puts on a mask, and I say, oh, my God, what is this, the Canadian mask superstar? I said, what's he going to do, take off the mask and become Canadian Demolition? And my color commentator looks at me, and I swear he was ready to smack me right then and there. Anyway, I digress.
Did Pedicino or anyone ever give you and Hudson some heat for when you'd sort of passive-aggressively bury stuff?
I think Hudson did it more than I did. I don't remember passive-aggressively burying stuff. I think the only time that we ever kind of winced on something was the whole Barcelona-Spain thing. I enjoyed what I was doing. I had no reason to bury stuff because people who know me will tell you that I have an ego of pride of what I do, but I don't have enough of an ego to think that what I think is anything better than anybody else's idea. So I never got any heat from Pedicino. Bill Eady gave us some heat every now and then, but I never. You know, Joe and I just have the fondest of memories of that whole time together. And like I said, I still consider Joe a very important person in my life. He's a wonderful guy, and so is Bonnie.
Now, when they
Bonnie is a wonderful person, not a wonderful guy. Let's not start anything there.
Now, they had to stop flying you in, and you had quite the odd exit.
Yeah, when I got in a pissing match with Bruce Pritchard, I said I want to go out with my pride intact. Yeah. I don't want people to think I'm quitting on them because I'm not the one that's quitting. Mm-hmm. Because they said you can do this for $50 a week and you have to move out here, and I said no, that ain't gonna happen. So. We knew Pritchard was staying. We knew Eddie was staying. So that's how my exit happened. Sadly, the last time anybody ever saw me was looking for the Viper, Mike Davis, in Akbar's office at the Sportatorium, which to this day I thought was one I did want to bury. But it was not the way I wanted to go out, but I was a little upset that the fact that we were all doing our jobs pretty darn well, and just because somebody else couldn't do their job properly, that it was costing us the opportunity to do something that we love. And I did love it. I had given up a Division I play-by-play job to take the job. And to not have it work out, I think I was a little upset about that.
I just remember it was a very sad exit, and it was never followed. It was never mentioned by any of the other announcers. It was just, you're in the office looking for the Viper. He's, like, under a desk being mysterious.
Yep.
You try to interview him. Cops come in, he disappears, and you're arrested, and you're never seen again by wrestling fans for 15 years.
Yeah. I totally forgot that that was the last time people saw me. Oh, my Lord. I remember the Viper angle, but I'd forgotten that I'd been arrested. Oh, God.
Yeah.
Thanks for bringing that up.
I got this ton of global that I picked up from someone, and I just, you know, find it. I'm like, oh, yeah. That's
yeah. Well, the Joe had a knack for wanting to pull practical jokes. And there was one that he didn't quite get on there because I was too naive to realize that it was a practical joke. Joe had set up this mix, match between Bull Payne and Sam Houston. And did a whole interview thing saying, we need to find somebody who's impartial, somebody who's strong enough to keep Baby Doll and Samantha apart, and somebody who can do the job, and we can't think of anybody better than Craig Johnson. And I'm like, what? So we're doing a television taping, and something goes wrong with our main camera. And I said, well, this is supposed to be a dark match anyway. Why don't we move up the Bull Payne and Samantha match? Well, what the gimmick was, or the Bull Payne and Sam Houston match, what the gimmick was of that was that I was handcuffed to both Samantha and Baby Doll. Now, if you kind of do the math there, that means I have two hands that are restrained in one way, and the two ladies have one to tear each other apart, or in this case, tear me apart with. Well, I didn't realize that the whole thing was a setup to be able to tape me getting humiliated on camera. So it never made air. And they were got all upset because they were going to make this as the start of what would now be known as a punked segment, where the joke was on me. And that segment died very quickly when I had kind of circumvented it. It was still one of my fondest memories of doing wrestling. The last thing I wanted in the world was me with no shirt appearing on national television.
So now go back to Atlanta, and you're at the tapings, you're raising hell. So you started the Shinanamaki Post newsletter.
Yes.
Which, how can one procure back issues of that?
Call Chick Donovan.
You know.
And you'll get a free autographed copy of the Bible autographed by the author, who Chick knows personally. I don't know if I actually did a Google search of the Shinanamaki Post, and I had put up text-only versions of like five of the issues on Rec Sport Pro Wrestling, one of the old internet news groups, many years ago. And when you Google Shinanamaki Post, it comes up. So some of the jokes are still there in cyberspace. The Shinanamaki Post itself was done on an old word processing program called AmiPro, which is no longer made. So I, until recently, had all the discs of all the Shinanamaki Posts, but no way to read them, which is kind of sad. But the postage due box set, the only complete set of the Shinanamaki Post that I know of, sits in Scott Hudson's office at the a federal Department of Justice down in Atlanta, Georgia. He has it actually sitting right by his desk. We always talk about the fact that we need to put that in the January issue, which is our way of saying we had unfinished business there when I moved to Seattle. We always wanted to continue it, but the joy of doing the Shinanamaki Post was Scott Hudson, Steve Prazak, and myself sitting with a laptop computer in a restaurant somewhere in Smyrna, Georgia, and just laughing our heads off for literally hours on end. That's why we did it. the fact that other people got the joke, that was just gravy. It was the camaraderie that the three of us had that just made that so much fun.
I've read the ones that you posted back in 1995,
mm-hmm.
and my absolute favorite part is the column you wrote in all capital letters.
God, I don't even remember that. Help me out here.
I actually have them right in front of me. So I actually linked these off my main site because I was discussing it a little with Dave Praise, Acna Relation, of course.
Right.
But, let me find it. And just remember, it was something like, you know, I've been told that my column, reading my columns, does not quite capture how I sound when I'm doing my announcing.
Yeah, that's about true. that says it right there.
Okay, I think it's in this last one you posted, February 1993. Come on. It's got to be in here.
Well, while you're looking for that, I will tell you. While you're looking for that, I'll give you a story from the Pinnacle, the Pinnacle tapings over the weekend. Back in the days, I never impersonated anybody, but I always had this exuberance about, you know, getting excited. Well, the ability to see Galavision, I get to watch Lucha Libre. So the thing that I've been known for the most when I did the AWA Washington taping over the weekend was anytime there was a low blow, you'd get this Dr. Alfonso Morales type foul. And once again, people would be looking at me and it was like, oh, what the heck? Let's throw a Lucha Libre reference in here. See if anybody catches it.
Okay, here I found it. Okay. Ray Johnson's Is This Thing On? All right, welcome to my column for the month. It was brought to my attention that my column did not look like I sounded, so I am catering to those fans by having everything in capital letters. This should prove to be obnoxious by the end of the column.
And to this day, I actually did did some consulting with a political campaign whose campaign manager would write her emails in capital letters. I said, don't you realize that in the world of cyberspace, you're considered yelling when you type in capital letters? And I think going back to that column, it's very true. People, there's a certain etiquette online these days where if you're typing in capital letters, you're yelling at somebody. So I think that was kind of a precursor to that.
I will email you after we're done. I found the link for a free AMI Pro to Word converter.
Now that all the discs are gone, great, thanks.
Oh, you got rid of them, great.
Yeah, but Hudson, like I said, Hudson still has multiple copies of each one, and I'll after we get off here, I'll take your email and send it to him and see if there's some way we can find you getting some old Shinnamaki posts.
Fantastic.
Offer limited to the first one person who calls in now. Oh, there's our caller.
So that was the, I just lost my train of thought, but,
now that's the typical WWE taping these days, losing your train of thought in the middle of the show. So there you go.
Just want to see if I can quickly run some things by you. Any special Eddie Gilbert stories? Besides him calling you a Richard Grieco lookalike.
When Eddie and Medusa came over to my house for a spaghetti dinner that I basically made right out of the microwave, it wasn't a very special dinner, and Eddie and Medusa made it seem as though I had worked all day on it and made me feel really special. Eddie was a truly special guy. I know he had his demons. I know he had his faults. But he was so creative and so wonderful to me. And I will always hold in dear memory when I think back of wrestling, of sitting on in the big couches at Joe Pedicino's house in Alpharetta, Georgia. In Kennesaw, Georgia. And, Kennesaw? Yeah, Kennesaw. And, we were going through a show. And I said, I have this idea for a character. And he goes, well, what is it? I said, what if we had a guy who's never won suddenly accidentally win, and he thinks he's become the winner and always considers, he hears the announcer say, here is your winner, and takes that as his nickname, and then never wins another match again, but still calls himself the winner. And of course, that was the birth of the Barry Horowitz gimmick. And the idea was, he said, write it out and let me see what it was. And I actually had it going for about 4 or 5 months where he would never win another match. He'd be counted out. He'd be disqualified. He'd never lose. He'd never have a three count, but he would never win. And the line would always be, well, I'm not the loser, therefore I must be the winner. And then that's when the winner's greatest hit came out. The tape,
moments,
which was actually a Muppets movie tape with a redone box, courtesy of Monty Blackstone. And Eddie gave me the courage to just say, what the heck? Go for a character on your own. And to this day, I think it was about maybe a couple years ago when I got an email from Barry Horowitz, who I happened to find online, and I just said, I just want to let you know I'm thinking of you. He goes, I cannot tell you how much I owe to you for just coming up with that idea. He said it changed my wrestling career. And to be able to have that sort of impact on somebody, you know, Eddie made that happen, and I will forever be thankful to him for allowing me to do that.
Let's see what else I got here to try to run through quickly.
Okay.
Okay. For some reason, my cousin asked you to ask me to ask you if you ever saw Chaz in the nude. I don't know why.
Thankfully, no. And even more thankfully, I didn't see Doug Taylor either.
Any Rip Rogers stories? They don't have to involve defecation.
Great Rip Rogers story. We're at the Georgia Mountain Center in Gainesville, Georgia. While Global was going on, and Steve Prazak and I are sitting in the second row at the Georgia Mountain Center for a television taping of Worldwide or something, mm-hmm, for WCW. And Rip Rogers is coming out as a jobber. And Steve and I, and I think this may be where the Atlanta Boys truly started, as we both stand up and start chanting, you're the boss! You're the boss! And Rip goes, shut up! You're going to get me in trouble! But that's my one and only Rip Rogers story.
Man, the Cartel was a hell of a group.
It was, and oh, God. And I think you might have mentioned this in your email to me the other day. How hard is it to imagine the guy known as Raven as the old Scotty the Body?
Man, I mean, he was awesome then.
Oh, he was just wonderful. I mean, when he used to channel the Florida wrestling announcer with a wing over sharpshooter takedown, you know, just start doing all this commentary like the Florida announcer, not solely the guy who worked with him. And he was just
John Heath.
That's it. That's exactly who that is. And then when he and Eddie would stand up with me and Scott, and we couldn't get a word edgewise, and I'd say chicken. I'd say there's a chicken wing, and he'd go, "Hey, let's go to Hooters," because we always went to Hooters after the wrestling matches. That was our tradition, because Hooters was right down the street.
Okay. Let's see, just what I covered. Chris Zellner, who was a regular at all the Atlanta area tapings, asked me to bring up Chick Donovan, but that happened already.
You've heard, I don't know if you're familiar with the Chick Donovan salute to the troops during Desert Storm, which we've talked about in the Shinanamaki Post on many occasions. But that's the ultimate Chick Donovan story. Chick Donovan shows up during Desert Storm, and I was not at this taping, but I've seen the tape. And he gets up in front of the crowd. He goes, I want all of you to get up, get on your feet, and salute our brave boys who are fighting for our country. So on the count of three, I want you all to say, overseas! 1, 2, 3! Overseas! Come home, boys!
Well.
So whenever Hudson or Prezak and I talk to each other, at least one time during the conversation, the word overseas comes into the conversation.
Wow. And he was a heel, keep this in mind, everyone.
Oh, yeah, he was. But he, oh, God. I don't, heaven knows if what chick was on. Human stunning hormones or something? I don't know.
My buddy Rob Naylor wanted me to ask you if you were around when Manny Fernandez started booking. I think you were gone by then, right?
When who?
Global. Manny Fernandez.
Oh, yeah, I wasn't around there. For the Raging Bull!
Manny Fernandez is Rob's favorite wrestler ever.
Well,
so he's all he wants to know.
No accounting for taste. Continue!
Anyway, I think that is just about it. I think I covered just about everything.
Well, good.
So thank you for this. I had a blast. I hope you had a good time.
I had a great time, and anytime you want to do part two, just let me know. I really enjoyed
it. Excellent. And check John out at Flying, I believe it's flyingcolorstv.com and flyingcolors.tv.
Well, the only one that'll be working is Flying Colors, British spelling, C-O-L-O-U-R-S.
Yes.
I have to be snobbish, don't I?
Yes.
But it's flyingcolorstv.com. That's my company website, and you're always welcome to check out what I'm doing these days, and hopefully we'll have some Pinnacle Wrestling stuff on there pretty soon.
Also, everyone check out PinnacleWrestling.com, which, you know, if they'll be selling a DVD of this show, or if they're just...
This show will definitely be on DVD. Even if it never makes it to television, it'll definitely be on DVD, and it'll be available at PinnacleWrestling.com.
Also, if you want to see him in action on any other old stuff, check out the various Classic Superstars of Wrestling DVDs, which... I'm sure I'll find some links to put up to on Amazon and High Spots.
I've been trying to buy them all up, but, you know, sometimes I haven't been successful.
What, to hide them or just so you can see them?
To hide them. Olu Oliami gave me a loan to buy them all up, and it just wasn't successful. Something about a credit card not going through.
Do you ever wonder if Olu Oliami sends people emails trying to get money out of them nowadays, being Nigerian and
yeah, they all start with the words highly respected.
Man. You know, that's like the biggest business in Nigeria.
I'm sorry, you broke up there. I didn't hear you.
That is the biggest business in Nigeria. Those emails.
I just have no clue. I get about 150 spam emails on each of my mailboxes every 8 hours. So that's one of the reasons I have a new website, because I had to get rid of the old domain, which is now being used for spam emails. So if you get one from flyingcolors.tv, it ain't me.
You got to use Gmail. They got a good spam filter. I'll send you an invite if you want.
Well, thanks.
Okay, but this was a lot of fun, and I'd like to thank you, and I'd like to have you on again. And, you know, I guess, yes, flyingcolorstv.com, and that's colors with a U, and also pinnaclewrestling.com. And I'd like to thank John. In 6 days, this coming Tuesday, I will be joined by Stephen Prezak, your cohort, for this to talk about, you know, various, I guess, topics related to what we talked about today, but other stuff such as Wild Side and all that. And I'm going to see if I can get anyone else on during the weekend. I'm going to probably have John Lister on soon, and working on a bunch of other fun guests, so keep looking at the website, davidbix.com, check out the forum, and as soon as I confirm someone as a guest, I will post in the forum there. The forum's linked off the sidebar on the main page, but anyway, you know, if you want to ask questions, you can post them there, and everyone have fun, I hope you're all enjoying it, and I guess that's about it. Once again, thank you, John, and that's it. So long.